Separating the policy from the politics, delving deeper into what is happening in our world today, and sharing the information you may not know if you didn't listen to this show. iHub Radio presents The Lovable Liberal. This is the Anita Rufus Show, civil discourse on current events and politics. Here's Anita.
And here I am, and thank you. There you are, and I appreciate you spending the next hour with me. This is Anita Rufus, the Lovable Liberal. This is iHub Radio. You can always listen live on iHubRadio.com. You can find podcasts there. If you go and look for my show and scroll down, you'll see where there are podcasts. Or wherever you get your podcasts, just enter iHub, the letter I, Hub, and Anita Rufus, and my shows will come up. I want to switch gears now and talk about the Biden administration and the Biden agenda. Joe Biden is our president. He is not yet even at 100 days in office. But of course, next year we have elections again, as we do every 2 years, for every single House seat. They're all up for election every 2 years. And for about a third of the U.S. Senate seats will be up for election. So Biden pretty much has this year to get done as much as he can get done, because next year is an election year and people go crazy and nobody wants to do anything that might have a repercussion on them running for re-election. The first thing that is a piece of good news today is that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, have extended the federal evictions moratorium through June 30th. As a result of the coronavirus and the fact that so many people have lost jobs or are not yet back to full employment, haven't been able to pay their rent, eviction moratorium is a good thing for the people who are paying rent and can't afford to pay rent right now. But there has to be some accommodation made for the people who own the buildings who still have to be making mortgage payments. Nevertheless, federal evictions moratorium through June 30th now. More than 8 million American households are behind on their rent. This is serious. Also, Biden has put out the names of the first slate of judicial nominees that he is going to bring forward, and it includes a real expansion of diversity on the federal bench. There's a woman named Ketanji Brown Jackson, Judge Jackson. She is a U.S. District Court judge now, and he's going to elevate her to the D.C. Circuit to succeed Merrick Garland, who was on the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court, which is the next court down from the Supreme Court. And it is presumed that Judge Jackson is someone that Joe Biden will want to elevate to the Supreme Court should an opening occur during his first term. The list of people that he is putting forward, the names to be on the federal judiciary, 3 black women would be appointed to the circuit court. And the first Muslim American would be named to serve on a U.S. district court. So this is another example of Joe Biden trying to fulfill the promises he made when he ran for office. Another issue that the Democrats have found important and are trying to push through, although there's a lot of pushback, and that is Washington, D.C. be given statehood. Now, there are constitutional objections because the Constitution sets aside a certain portion of the land of what is now Washington, D.C., to be held as the seat of government. And that would include things like the White House and the Supreme Court building and Congress. But the argument that's going on is between those somewhat arcane constitutional objections and fulfilling the ideal of a representative government in the United States. So, a bill that has been sponsored by the House of Representatives, H.R. 51, would convert all but a sliver of Washington, D.C. into a new state. Now, it turns out Republicans have done this in the past for their own partisan purposes. Republicans are claiming, oh, the only reason Democrats want to do this is because they want to get two more senators. That's why they want to make Puerto Rico a state so they can get two more senators. I'd just like to point out, if the Republicans want to reach more of the voters who they automatically presume will be Democrats, why don't they put out policies that appeal to those voters instead of trying to restrict who can vote or continue to restrict the representation of people who are American citizens by birth? If you're born in Puerto Rico, you are an American citizen. If you're born in Washington, D.C., you are an American citizen, but you don't have representation in the Senate at all, and your representation in the House is kind of, you get to send somebody, but they don't really have a voice or a say in what happens. Now, I didn't realize this, but the Dakota Territory, which today is North Dakota and South Dakota, in 1889, the Republican Party lobbied successfully to split the Dakota Territory into two states, because that meant that they could pick up four senators. The founders' intent was to set aside this area that is in Washington, D.C., the requirement that the seat of government would be in a federal district controlled by Congress. And it was said that it could not exceed 10 square miles. Well, did the Constitution's writers foresee shrinking that district to only a 2 mile square enclave? We don't know. They just said it couldn't be more than 10 square miles. In 2 square miles, you could have the Supreme Court, the White House, the Capitol, and the Mall. And this bill that was introduced, H.R. 51, would honor the Constitution's requirement that the seat of government be in a federal district controlled by Congress. But the rest of what is currently Washington, D.C., would become the 51st state. Now, it is true that there was a point where some area was given back to, like, Maryland. Most of the district was given back to Maryland, providing that the district's 700 citizens could have congressional representation. It's called retrocession. And this is an alternative to making D.C. a separate state. It's obviously the alternative that's favored by the Republicans. It means Democrats would get one more representative in the House, because that number of people being added to Maryland would mean there were enough people to set aside a separate congressional district. So Democrats would probably pick up that seat, but they wouldn't get two more senators. And they wouldn't get any extra electoral votes. Maryland currently gets 3 electoral votes, I believe. Anyway, who would get electoral votes if that happened? That still has to be decided, and that can have an impact on who ends up being elected president. So this issue of DC statehood, there are still issues to be resolved. Republicans would like what they call retrocession, which is where most of the district goes back to the state of Maryland, which, by the way, Maryland isn't real excited about that either. But it does mean that D.C. would not become a state, with the exception of that one small area. D.C. would not become a state, and the presumption that if it did become a state, it would automatically have two senators who would be Democrats, that goes away. This is an argument that is yet to be concluded. Meanwhile, President Biden has put forth some very progressive legislation, this multi-trillion dollar infrastructure package, which includes a whole lot of ambitious climate policy goals, and it can reasonably be referred to as a jobs bill. The administration wants to transform the country's energy mix with regulations and executive orders. And they want to deploy 30 gigawatts worth of offshore electricity generation by 2030. So they're already looking at where they might put wind farms out into the Atlantic. Under the Paris Agreement, which America has now rejoined on the environment, as a result of President Biden being elected, the State Department is going to unveil our new emissions targets under that Paris Agreement. And this will signal to other countries that are part of the Paris Agreement how ambitious our country is about tackling climate change after 4 years of an administration that pulled us out of the Paris Agreement and frankly couldn't have cared a damn about climate change. Also, the White House will be hosting in April a virtual climate summit to encourage other countries to make far-reaching reduction plans themselves. President Biden is trying to put us back into a leading role on environmental issues and not leave the playing field primarily to China, which they have already begun to take advantage of. His bill that he's proposing for infrastructure and people's issues is very ambitious, and I'll tell you what's in it when we come back.
She's lovable, she's liberal, and she's here to bring a tone of civility to political discussion you aren't likely to find anywhere else. The Anita Rufus Show, with your lovable liberal on iHub Radio. Here's Anita.
Okay, President Biden has put out some of the details of the infrastructure plan that he is proposing. And he called the plan, and this is a quote, a once-in-a-generation investment in America, unlike anything we've seen or done since we built the interstate highway system and since the space race. The public investment in infrastructure has been in decline as a share of our gross domestic product for more than 50 years. And for the record, President Trump, when he was in office, proposed his own $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan, but it never became law, and it was never strongly pushed in Congress. Now, this is also being characterized as a jobs bill. Democrats have been countering the idea that this job is that this bill is job killing, which is the thing that the Republicans are saying against it. But Democrats are saying, you know, that's just not true. Combating climate change would, in fact, create well-paying new jobs. This is going from rebuilding 20,000 miles of roads that need rebuilding to eliminating lead in the water pipes in this country. Duh! Here's what's in this over $2 trillion bill. $621 billion for transportation infrastructure. And that includes things like public transportation, trains, roads. $111 billion would go to clean drinking water. And the way the president described that, it was, you know, plumbers and pipe fitters will get jobs transforming every water system in this country to make sure that no child is ever again exposed to lead in the water they drink. $100 billion would go to high-speed broadband. There are far too many people in this country who do not have access to the internet, out in rural areas, out in the middle of nowhere where you can't get a signal. $100 billion would go to the power infrastructure, making sure that we had protections in place for our electricity and other forms of power. $213 billion would be for affordable housing. And what's wrong with that? Do we want people living on the streets? No. $137 billion would go toward schools, upgrading schools, and toward child care. And if there's anything seriously needed to be discussed in this country, it is child care. Women cannot hold down jobs when they are seen as the primary caregivers to children. And men certainly aren't picking up their share of the slack, even in this last year when so many aren't even at work. $100 billion would go toward workforce development, retraining, things like that. $400 billion would go toward home care for the aging and those with disabilities. And I heard somebody on right-wing talk radio on my way to the station today who said, well, how does that have anything to do with infrastructure? And why do we need home care for adults? If you have an older member of your family who needs that kind of care, you know the answer to that question. And if nothing else, we must get Medicare to pay for home care so that we are not putting the burden on Medicare for older people by shoving them into warehousing that costs much, much more than it would cost if we were paying for their at-home care. They also want to eliminate subsidies for fossil fuel companies. Frankly, I don't have a problem with that. I don't know why we're giving subsidies to companies that, in fact, are not necessary for what we need going forward. Now, there's also the people issues bill that he will put forth. And this is an effort to rein in economic inequality by expanding in three major areas: healthcare, extending the 2-year provisions in the COVID relief package that cut costs for nearly everyone who goes for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, what's known as Obamacare. They also want to try and reduce prescription drug prices by making sure, for example, that drug manufacturers have to negotiate prices with Medicare. They want to make sure that universal free education is available for pre-kindergarten all the way through community college. And they want to make sure that family and paid leave is available. It is something that is provided for workers in every other country that is a major economic country. We have got to move toward universal child care and paid family leave when it is needed to care for a sick child or a sick parent. It's time we made it easier for people to live and to make a living and to pursue their dreams in this country.
The Lovable Liberal continues now on iHub Radio. Here's Anita Rufus.
So I want to share with you just as a way to cap off what I was talking about with regard to the president's agenda. There's a growing push among federal lawmakers for something that they call a road user fee to fund highway repairs. And this may actually be a good idea. The existing federal gas tax is not enough to meet rising costs. Now, you know, there's a federal gas tax and then states have their own taxes they put on every gallon of gas. And it turns out that the federal gas tax is really quite low and doesn't cover funding a lot of what the federal government is committed to do with regard to roads. And the budget gap is only going to grow wider as cleaner cars burn less fuel. So there'll be less of the taxes being paid. One area of possible agreement between the parties, as if that could exist regardless, is a vehicle miles traveled system, VMT, that would charge drivers a penny or two for each mile they log behind the wheel. Drivers would report their mileage electronically with a plug-in device in their car or a smartphone app. And supporters say it's a way to ensure that electric vehicle owners who currently pay no fuel taxes would have to chip in their fair share for maintenance of the roads. And shouldn't everybody who's using the roads have to help maintain them? Now, the question that came up for me in this system, which makes sense when you just say it, the question that came up for me is, what about people, working class people, who live farther from work in order to be able to find affordable housing? I'm thinking of the people who work, for example, in downtown LA, but live in Moreno Valley, which is a real schlep on the freeway back and forth every day. But it's where they could afford to find homes that they could go into. Is it fair to charge them more when, in fact, they may make less and have to drive farther? Those are the kinds of considerations that people who write these laws have to take into account. Now, as far as paying for the overall package that the president is proposing, this $2 trillion, give or take, there are four tax increases that are worth about $1.8 trillion that would pay for this infrastructure and part of this social safety net. The biggest ticket item is raising the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%, which is still less than it was before Trump came in and cut tax rates. That would be worth over $730 billion in taxes over a 10-year period. Also, they can impose a global minimum tax on profits from foreign subsidiaries. That would raise $550 billion. And shouldn't there be some tax on profits that American companies make from facilities they have overseas? Third, they would tax capital gains as regular income for the wealthy. And by the way, they also want to tax unrealized capital gains at death. Those two capital gains taxes would raise about $370 billion. And when you hear Republicans and opponents to this talking about the death tax, which is a great phrase that the pundits came up with as a way to make people not want to change the estate tax, you need to know that unless you're leaving an estate worth several million dollars, you're not going to get taxed anyway. Anyway, the fourth thing they would do is return the top individual rate, tax rate, for those who make more than $400,000 back to the rate that it was before Trump came into office, 39.6%, but only for those making more than $400,000 a year. The president has absolutely promised that he will not raise taxes on those who make less than $400,000 a year. Now, the Republicans are going to say, well, we've put together this conservative group called the Coalition to Protect American Workers. One of the leaders of that is the guy who was Mike Pence's chief of staff when Pence was vice president. This group is going to spend about $25 million on TV and digital ads to target members of Congress and moderate or vulnerable Democrats to fight against the idea of this infrastructure and public service legislation and the change in tax rates, but only for those making more than $400,000 a year. The Coalition to Protect American Workers. This is how pundits come up with these cool names to try and, frankly, bamboozle people who won't look farther than the name of the organization. Oh, they want to protect American workers. When the truth is, it is the Biden plan that would, in fact, give lots of jobs, including protection for workers. Now, for your right-wing friends, if you want to lord it over them a little bit, you know how Donald Trump was constantly touting how much the stock market was worth as if that had something to do directly with him. Well, guess what? The Standard & Poor's 500 increased by 4.6% during the first 50 trading days of the Biden administration. Trump's first 50-day bump was 4.4%. Biden's is 4.6%. And Biden is outperforming Trump with regard to the increase in the Dow Industrials. I personally don't think that may necessarily be a good thing. I feel like we're back in the roaring 20s and hoping that there won't be a crash. But if you have Republican friends who keep saying, oh, well, look how great the economy was under Donald Trump, this is a way to have something to come back with that'll make you feel good. May not make them feel good, but it'll make you feel good. Before I get to some of the stuff that you may not know if you didn't listen to this show, which I always try and end the show with, Randy Florence will be on after my show from 3 to 4 this afternoon, and Randy Florence is going to be talking to Dick Oliphant, who is a developer and city leader here locally, and he's going to talk about the growth in desert cities. And then from 4 to 6, John McMullen will be here with all the day's big stories and a local perspective. So that's worth tuning in for. Okay, stuff you might not know if you didn't listen to this show. Let me start with the fact that New York is legalizing marijuana for a potential $4.2 billion in income coming into the state. The Virginia State Supreme Court has ruled that Charlottesville does have permission to remove Confederate statues. You'll remember that Charlottesville is where that horrible event took place, supposedly because demonstrators wanted to make sure that the statue of Robert E. Lee wouldn't come down. Well, the Virginia State Supreme Court overturned a lower court in favor of a group of residents who originally wanted to block the city from taking down the statue of Robert E. Lee and a nearby monument to General Thomas Stonewall Jackson. White supremacist and neo-Nazi organizers of that August 2017 rally called Unite the Right in Charlottesville, where President Trump said there were good people on both sides. The state Supreme Court judge said both statues were erected long before the passage of a law in the state of Virginia that's supposed to regulate the disturbance or interference with war memorials or monuments. So the fact that it was 1918 when the city accepted a resident's offer to donate land for parks for both those two white supremacist statues, state Supreme Court said the law did not provide the authority for the city to erect the statues, and it does not prohibit the city from deciding it wants to take them down. That's good news. The Supreme Court, this is going to frost your right-wing friends too. The Supreme Court of the United States has said that Hillary Clinton does not have to testify regarding her emails in the Benghazi case. My God, there is still a Benghazi case, for heaven's sake. Supreme Court on Monday left in place a lower court order that blocked Judicial Watch, which is a conservative group, from deposing former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about her use of a private email account related to the 2012 attack in Benghazi in Libya. A federal appeals court ruled last August that Clinton cannot be compelled to appear for a deposition in a lawsuit about State Department emails, and they overturned a lower court. So now the Supreme Court has supported that decision. Judicial Watch had asked to depose Clinton in a case seeking public access to the emails from the State Department regarding this thing about Benghazi, that somehow or other Hillary's private email server must have had something to do with that. God, they want so badly to find her guilty of something. A reality going on right now in the United States is something to at least be aware of, because the influence of religious groups has been diminishing over time. And right now, what they have found, Gallup has been asking this question for 83 years about membership in houses of worship. And the reality is that Gallup found that in 2020, only 47% of American adults belonged to a church, synagogue, or mosque. In 1937, 73% of Americans belonged to an organized religion. In 1999, it had fallen to only 70%. Now it's only 47%. And I guess the question that comes to me is, are people going to alternative ways of believing, or is religion just not adapting to reality and people are not finding that it satisfies the questions they have about life and its meaning and how to relate to what's going on in the world around them? I'll be back with some more stuff you wouldn't know if you didn't listen to this show. This is Anita Rufus, the Lovable Liberal, on iHub Radio.
The Lovable Liberal continues now on iHub Radio. Here's Anita Rufus.
Okay, I want to end the show with a few items that, you know, there are times when I come across a news item and I think, how dense do you have to be? Like the fact that Kristi Noem, the woman who is the governor of, is it North Dakota, has come out and done an executive order that would prohibit transgender women from playing sports on women's teams. So this one I've titled, how could a high school football coach think that anti-Semitic play calls were okay? Now, I am serious. This is a real item. The head football coach at a school in Massachusetts called Duxbury High School reportedly, you know, they do these audible calls. So they practice these things, and either the coach from the sidelines can call it in, or the quarterback when they're in the huddle can tell the players. And they identify certain plays with just one word so everybody knows what they're supposed to do. This head football coach at this high school in Massachusetts came up with the names for his audible play calls. One was Auschwitz, one was Hitler, and one was Holocaust. How dense do you have to be? Peyton Manning used to use the play name Omaha. Some use Seattle for a play heading left, or Philly for a play heading right. But Auschwitz, Hitler, and Holocaust? Who is this idiot? And what the hell was he teaching high school kids? Now here's another one that I'm titling it, do these people just not give a crap, or are they just plain stupid? One of the rioters who is accused in the January 6th raid on the United States Capitol was arrested wearing a t-shirt that says, I was there, with a picture of Donald Trump on the front. And the date, January 6th. He's not only accused of breaching the Capitol with a gun, by the way, for those right-wingers who say, well, they weren't armed. Duh. This guy is accused of breaching the Capitol with a gun and making a death threat to one of the representatives in Congress, wearing a shirt that says, I was there January 6th with a picture of Donald Trump. How dense do you have to be? Finally, I do want to share with you, I am a basketball fan, although I tend to like professional rather than college. But what's going on right now with the Final Four and what's been happening in the NCAA, while I have been most interested in what the women have managed to accomplish after having been treated as truly second-class citizens for far too long. But I gotta say, this is exciting. Gonzaga, which you may never have even heard of, but Gonzaga is a college, university, that is unbeaten. They haven't lost a single game. And they trounced the University of Southern California. And to my friend Linda in Florida, I say, I'm really sorry about that, Linda. She is the most rabid USC fan I've ever known in my life. Also, UCLA, which was seeded 11th, beat Michigan, which had been seeded number one. I am a UCLA fan, and my granddaughter is currently a student at UCLA. So I want to say, I'm real pleased about that result. Now, I also want to share something with you that that is kind of personal to me. And I've always known that I would spend my whole life speaking out and fighting for the things I care about. To be honest with you, I didn't know I'd spend my whole life fighting for the same things over and over and over and over and over again. I thought we would at least make enough progress that we could move on to something else. I am now of the opinion that a lot of the things I have spent my life fighting for, particularly as it relates to women and their place in this society, I'm going to need to leave to younger women, many of whom have grown up assuming that they had the right to do things that I had to fight for. And good for them. Move it forward. And I want to share with you that each of us can move the ball forward one step at a time, one day at a time, because that's how we make progress. I truly believe there is a continuum of evolution from whatever the earliest water-bound molecule we may have been before we managed to become who we are as a species. And I know that where we are going, we're not there yet. And I would hope that we just continue making progress one step at a time. Yes, occasionally we take a step back. It gives us a chance to reassess what we're doing and decide to move forward yet again. Sometimes we have to change the path we're on. Sometimes that step forward has to go in a new direction, and that's okay. One of the ways I will share with you, because this occurred to me today on the road. I was pulled up on a road where I was in the second lane from the right, and the right-hand lane was a right turn only lane that went on the freeway going north. I was staying on the second lane because that was a lane that would go forward and then be a right turn only lane to go south. In that right lane next to me was a big SUV, a lot bigger than my car, and he had stopped because obviously he was in the wrong lane thinking he was going to go north and wanted to go south. And I saw him and I honked my horn slightly and moved my hand to tell him to move over. And when traffic began to move again, I stayed on my brake to leave room for him to change lanes. And I decided I want to leave you with that admonition today. You want to make the world a better place? There are ways to do it one tiny step at a time. And one tiny step, let somebody in to change lanes in front of you. It will only stall your progress by a few seconds. And that's something that person can remember all day as someone they didn't know having done something nice. Have a good day.